Socialism is our topic. Our guest is Bill Federer. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. Bill, you've written many, many books, and congratulations on that, including some best-selling books. But now you've written a new book about socialism, trying to show how this relatively new problem, or seemingly new problem, is not new at all. In fact, it goes way back, even before the times of Christ. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Sure. Now, your website is AmericanMinute.com. Let's go ahead and get the commercial out of the way. What is the name of the book? And then explain, why did you write it?
Right. So the website is AmericanMinute.com. And the book is titled Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. And then the subtitle is How the Deep State Uses Crises to Consolidate Control. And so go all the way back to Plato. Every book that talks about socialism goes back to Plato. He first says there's a democracy. Demos means people, krasi means rule. And he says the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. Everybody tolerates each other. It's got different views. And he says it's like going to a bazaar, a marketplace, and you can buy any viewpoints, like an embroidery patchwork with lots of colors. It's wonderful. He said it's the most charming form of government. And then they begin to tolerate people that are a little bit off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off. So finally, they're tolerating crooks and crime and fraud and, you know, broad daylight assaults, and nobody does anything about it. And then it turns into this chaos. And he says the young man gives into libertinism and useless and unnecessary pleasures, even incest and unnatural union. So it's casting off of sexual restraints. And then he says the young man is disrespectful to the father. And if he gets corrected, he just shakes his head and walks away. And the teachers want to lower themselves to the level of the students so they'll be accepted. And then he says it gets into the handling of their finances. And since it's a democracy, they just vote to spread the wealth around. Now the treasury's empty. And then they vote to take money from the rich people. Now there's no rich left. And then there's a shortage. They begin to bicker and fight. It turns into domestic chaos. And then everyone begins to say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's when somebody comes along, they promise them to fix it, but they need to take a little of your rights, a little of your freedom, a little bit of your independence. And finally, they stand in the chariot of state holding the reins of power, and they're revealed as the tyrant. So democracy without morals and virtue ends in domestic chaos out of which a tyrant arises. And so Plato says the best you can hope for is a nice tyrant. He called him a philosopher king, and he's the head of gold, and his administrators and military are the arms and chest of silver. They're the ruling class. And then the people are the abdomen of iron and bronze. And they're the ruled class. And so this is the beginning of socialism. It's a socially structured society with the ruling class and the ruled class. And so the deep state ruling class controls everything. They get to decide who has children and who can't. Everybody else, there's no private property. There's no privacy. You don't even get your own children. The state takes the children away from the families, brings them into the city, and indoctrinates them with noble lies, even calls them lies. But it's okay because that helps the philosopher king to stay in power and says he's the only thing you can hope for, that you're stuck, sort of stuck with it. And so fast forward 2,000 years, and you got Columbus discovering America. 20 years later, Sir Thomas More writes Island of Utopia. And it's this fictitious island off the coast of South America.
Can I stop you for real fast? I studied Greek, and utopia literally means no place. This does not exist. This is total fiction. All right, go on.
Right, and then it's written like Plato as a dialogue where you got two guys talking. And so this island of utopia, the person is talking to a traveler. And I apologize for not pronouncing the name right, but the traveler's name is Richard Highland Dais or something like that, which means peddler of nonsense. And so it's written as a satire on the dominating control that King Henry VIII has. And, of course, King Henry VIII eventually kills Sir Thomas More.
Right.
But he writes it as this veiled mockery of this class society in England. But nevertheless, he does write it, this island of utopia, and what? Everything is owned in common. Nobody has private property. You cannot travel without a passport. The government wants to track everyone's travel. If you're caught without a passport, it is a lifetime of slavery. And everyone lives in identical three-story houses. Everyone wears identical clothes. You eat in a communal setting like a monastery. There's no families. The government owns all the kids, indoctrinates them. It's the same thing as Plato, only this is spelled out a little bit. Now, Plato, he is making these veiled references back to Atlantis, this highly advanced civilization, highly structured, you know, successful, militaristic, and then it offends the Greek gods and is sunk under the sea. So Plato refers to Atlantis as this ideal island's perfect society. And so that is what Sir Thomas More is hinting at. And then you skip forward another century, and you have Sir Francis Bacon, and he actually writes The New Atlantis. And this is an island in the South Pacific, and it's highly structured, a little more scientific this time around, but still it's a controlled class society. And somebody writes a farce on it named Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. And so Gulliver's Travel, what, the guy's washed up on an island, and it's highly structured with this ruling class that, you know, is irrational, and then the ruled class that doesn't have any rights. And so this is all theoretical. But Sir Francis Bacon lives at the time of Shakespeare, Queen Elizabeth, and the Pilgrims. And so the Pilgrims had a company colony. And the company colony had bylaws written by a bunch of investors who thought they were really smart. And what did they do? They looked at Sir Francis Bacon, Sir Thomas More, and Plato. They wrote the bylaws, and William Bradford said they tried them, and they nearly starved to death. And he says that we tried this experiment in communal living, in this communistic plan, and it proved the emptiness of the theory of Plato, applauded recently by, you know, many scholars, that the owning of things in common would bring happiness as if they were wiser than God. Mm. He says the young men objected to doing three times as much work as the old guy, but not getting any more recompense. The old guy objected to being classed in labor with the younger and humbler one and considered it a disrespect. And the ladies objected to having to wash other men's clothes. And he says, after going through a couple of winters without any food, he said, we had to come up with a better plan. And so after much debate, they decided to give each family their own plot of land. This made all hands more industrious, so much so that women would now go willingly into the field and bring their little ones with them, where before to have forced them would have been considered great oppression, and many would have objected to it. And so this was all the Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon, that's all theoretical. The Pilgrims actually tried to live out this communal thing, and it failed.
And you know what? And if it failed with the Pilgrims, who were very devout Christians, they were wonderful examples of piety and so forth. If it failed with them, it'll fail with anybody and everybody. And it fails everywhere, by the way. Can you name one square inch on planet Earth where socialism was tried and it succeeded?
No, it hasn't. And the reason being is that, I track it. So you got four steps. You got Pilgrims had a covenant. Now, what's a covenant?
We got 4 minutes left. 4 minutes left. Go on.
It's people in agreement with each other, but more than agreement, you're committed to help each other. And you get rights from God, accountable to God. So the covenant's sort of like a triangle. Well, in the next century, covenant turned into social contract. And it's just people in agreement with each other. And if God is there, he's distant and impersonal. And this comes from the scientific revolution, Sir Isaac Newton discovering laws of planetary motion, laws of gravity, laws of optics, Robert Boyle discovering laws of pressure. And so the philosophers would say, gee, maybe God set up everything with laws, and like a guy winds up a clock and sets it on a shelf, it just runs its course. And so the social contract under the Age of Enlightenment is there's a distant God. Well, in the next century, it turned into social contract with no God and the French Revolution. Mm. And you get your rights from the state, you're accountable to the state. In the next century, it was socialism and Marxism, which says the state is God. So it's sort of like the whole triangle inverted. So you go from Pilgrim Covenant with a personal God to Age of Enlightenment, social contract with a distant God, to French Revolution, social contract with no God, to Marxism, socialism, where the state is God. And you have Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract. He says, when the state says to a citizen, you should die, that citizen should die because his life is a gift made conditionally by the state.
Oh, my gosh.
And then you have Napoleon conquering Europe, and the King of Prussia said, we can't get conquered that easy. We need to strengthen our state. So he gets a philosopher named Hegel, the University of Berlin. Hegel said, the state is God walking on earth. The state is our mortal God. Well, who went to the University of Berlin and was a member of this radical young Hegelian group was Marx. Karl Marx.
Yeah.
And so all of this idea of the state being God goes into Marxism, goes into socialism. And then in the book, I talk about how bottom-up forms of covenant government flip and turn into top-down, and it's in times of crises. So I'm skipping past a bunch of stuff, but
sure,
let's look
sure.
at the Weimar Republic in Germany. And you have
pre-Nazi Germany. Pre-Nazi Germany.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you have Hitler voted in by one vote as chancellor, and then he has a very violent group called the Brown Shirts. They're also called stormtroopers, where they would storm into the meetings of Hitler's opponents and shout down the leaders and disrupt the meeting. They're sort of like Antifa. And then they would go into the inner cities and smash the city. They would, in the Kristallnacht, they smashed the windows of 7,000 Jewish stores and businesses and synagogues. And then they would lock arms. There's pictures of them locking arms, blocking access to buildings, and blocking streets. Could you imagine people standing there locking arms, blocking streets? And then they set the Capitol on fire, the Reichstag. And in the confusion, Hitler rounds up his political opponents, has them shot without a trial. And then Hitler begins to, what? He kills all the brown shirts in the Night of the Long Knives.
Wow.
They were a radical homosexual group led by Ernst Röhm. And so once they're killed, everybody praises Hitler as cracking down on this terrorist group. And when the dust settles, they realize they just flipped from a republic, the Weimar Republic, to a dictatorship with a Führer, a Hitler top down. Now, after World War II.
2 minutes left.
Germany, France, England give independence to their former colonies. And in a perfect world, that would be great, except the Soviet Union wants to take over these and make them satellites of the Soviet Union. And so they send in KGB agents into these countries who would identify groups that had grievances, racial discrimination, economic discrimination, and they would organize them to protest and riot. And then they would co-opt the media with bribes and threats to blame the leader. Then they would find weak links in the military, and when the country got to a fevered pitch, they would do a coup, arrest the leader, or have a rigged election, and install a Soviet puppet. And there'd be peace now because there's no more riots, but then the people wake up to realize they just became a totalitarian dictatorship.
Mm.
And so they were doing this in Hungary, in Poland, in the Czech Republic, in Romania, and Truman sat back and did nothing because he thought the United Nations would bring world peace. But Eisenhower is a different story. He decided to fight fire with fire. So the Soviets have a leader in Iran named Mossadegh, and he nationalizes the oil industry. And you say, what's that? Well, there, from 1908 on was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. You know it better as BP. And it supplied all the oil for England and the British Navy. And so once this is nationalized, the British don't have any oil. They go to Eisenhower, say, help. Eisenhower has Kermit Roosevelt Jr., the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. He is the CIA operative, and they do the first CIA operation to overthrow a country's leader. It's called Operation Ajax. And Kermit Roosevelt Jr. goes to Tehran, and he recruits mobsters, radical imams, criminals.
Wow.
He bribes and threatens the media. They do protests and riots and attack mosques.
Okay, Bill, we have 30 seconds to wind up. Go ahead.
Anyway, blames Mossadegh. And they install a new leader. The difference this time around is we're seeing this operation on our own soil. We already know there's deep state people, CIA, FBI, Department of Justice, that do not like the president. They've been trying to get rid of him. This is just, they've had 70 years of practicing these things. And you have pallets of bricks dropped off in cities, right, where there's riots. Somebody is orchestrating this. Anyway, it's all in the book. It's called Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. And my website's AmericanMinute.com.
Bill Federer, always a pleasure. It sounds like this is the history we never knew, but the history we need to know. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure, Bill. God bless you.
Thank you.